neue Wörter für ein altes Geschäft. Ein elektronischer Raum im physischen Raum.
Playback. Willkommen zu O-Ton Playback bei Radio Dreieckland. Hamza Hovidi, Exil und Engagement, eine palästinensische Sicht auf Frieden und Demokratie. Wir senden den Mitschnitt der Diskussionsveranstaltung im Nordpol in Dortmund am 17.07.2025. Das Nordpol schreibt dazu: Hamza Abu Hovidi ist palästinensischer Autor, Friedensaktivist und Überlebender politischer Verfolgung. In Gaza engagierte er sich für soziale Gerechtigkeit, Meinungsfreiheit und Menschenrechte in einem System, das genau das brutal unterdrückt. Die islamistische Hamas verfolgte, inhaftierte und folterte ihn. Heute lebt Hovidi im deutschen Exil. Er ist ein unbequemer, klarer Kritiker, nicht nur der Hamas und der rechtsextremen israelischen Regierung, sondern auch aller Formen von Antisemitismus. Sein Engagement gilt einer politischen Vision jenseits nationalistischer Mythen und religiösem Fanatismus, für Verständigkeit und Gerechtigkeit zwischen palästinensischen und israelischen Communities. Er schreibt und spricht regelmäßig über die Situation in Gaza, die palästinensische Not und seinen Weg von der Radikalisierung zum Aktivisten und politischen Analysten. An diesem Abend berichtete er aus persönlicher Erfahrung über die Realität des Lebens in Gaza, über politische Repression durch die Hamas, seine Flucht ins Exil und seinen Einsatz für gewaltfreie, zukunftsorientierte Lösungsansätze. Uns war es wichtig, einer Stimme Raum zu geben, die selten zu hören ist. Nicht, weil es sie nicht gibt, sondern weil sie im öffentlichen Diskurs marginalisiert wird. Eine palästinensische Perspektive gegen Gewalt, gegen Fanatismus, gegen die Logik der Zerstörung. Die Veranstaltung versucht dazu beizutragen, über neue Perspektiven für Gaza nachzudenken, über Hoffnung inmitten der Krise, über demokratische Ansätze unter schwierigen Bedingungen und darüber, wie gelebte Solidarität heute aussehen kann. Von der Diskussionsveranstaltung mit Hamza Hovidi vom Juli 2025 senden wir im Folgenden den ersten Teil.
Welcome to tonight's event, Exile and Engagement, a Palestinian Perspective on Peace and Democracy, held here at Nordpol, Dortmund, and kindly supported by the city of Dortmund. Thanks for that. Our guest, Hamza Abu Hovidi, is a Palestinian activist, writer, and peace advocate. Born and raised in Gaza, he stood up for human rights and was imprisoned and tortured by Hamas. Now living in exile in Germany, he continues to speak out against Hamas, against antisemitism, and for peace, understanding between Palestinians and Israelis. We are honored to have Hamza with us tonight to share his story, his insights, and his vision for peace and democracy in the face of violence and repression. One further note from Tom Khaled Würdemann, who visited us last year, and he had one saying which I kept in my mind. Most of what passes for Israel solidarity or Palestine solidarity on the German left is not a position of solidarity, but enthusiasm for reactionary political projects. Solidarity with Israel or Palestine only makes sense if it is subordinated to a fundamental peace perspective. So we invite you to a critical discussion and debate, but based on respect, listening, and genuine interest. Contributions that seek to delegitimize this event as a whole are not welcome. Be it through general suspicion, personal attacks, deliberate distraction from the topic, or shifting the debate onto sidetracks. We will not tolerate the deliberate destruction of this discussion space. Thank you, and now we will start with you, Hamza.
So first of all, thanks actually for the quote. I didn't see it coming, but I appreciate it. And Tom is also a very dear friend. I mean, he actually introduced us to each other. So yeah, before starting, just two simple points. As you introduced me very well, thank you for that. But I also as I criticize Hamas, I also criticize the Israeli government's actions, the army, the Israeli settlers. The list goes on. There is like, I don't like to do this polarization. Those are the good people and those are the bad people. This is one thing. The second thing, if you expect me to have the magic trick for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, I'm sorry, I don't have it. I'm just going to tell about my personal life and from my life experience, what I can tell what is wrong and shouldn't be done and what I think can be a better solution for the current situation. So yeah, I'm Hamza Abu Houaidi. I was born and raised in the Gaza Strip. I was born in 1997, which was a spicy period, let's say, between Palestine and Israel, because it had many events, if we are talking about post the peace accords, then to the second intifada, then to the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, and the list goes on. So it was a very intense period. I was born in a Rimal neighborhood, which is in the heart of Gaza City. You have the Gaza Strip, and you have the Gaza City, which is in the middle. And as everyone else, I was just born there. I did not choose to be born there, and I had to live with all the difficulties that comes when we are a Palestinian or an Israeli in this conflict. And during my childhood, I did not have the privilege, let's say, to see how it was when Israel was occupying Gaza, or to see much things when the Palestinian Authority already also received the Gaza Strip from Israel in 2005. So I was still a young boy, did not have a lot of memories from that. Most of my memories actually came after Hamas took over the Gaza Strip, and I still remember in my neighborhood in Al Rimal, because it was in the middle of the city, you have the government buildings, the parliament, everything, so most of the events happened there. And I still remember the coup when Hamas took over the Gaza Strip, how they attacked the people from the Palestinian Authority or the Fatah political faction in Gaza, and how they started killing them, throwing them from buildings, dragging people with motorcycles, dead and alive. It was lots of terrible memories that shook us, that shook me and shook everyone in Gaza, because when Hamas came to power, their political slogan, I still remember it, was a change and reform. And everyone was pissed off of the Palestinian Authority. It's corruption. We wanted a change and reform, actually, and many voted for that. But we did not expect that reform, let's say, or that change. And I had this little bit trauma from seeing these events without having any idea what's happening, actually. Anyway, we continued with Hamas. And after Hamas took over the power in 2007, they started reshifting everything in Gaza. It was not a simple coup. For example, they replaced all the teachers in Gaza from the schools. So they put in their own teachers. They took the religious figures, they put their religious figures, and I think we can all imagine what Hamas brought to Gaza. I went as a child to Dar al-Arqam school, which is Hamas owned and run school, actually, because there is no much options, and it was very close to the Israeli border, and I was raised there, and there in the school, because of Hamas's teachers and the indoctrination, it was more about indoctrination more than it's about having a normal life, actually, in school. At the age of 10 or 12, I was like memorized third of the Quran, most of these scripts, and the school lines, having to sing about martyrdom and how we love death more than they love life, etc. So it wasn't actually a very nice period. Still, at the same time, it was not only Hamas who were oppressing Gaza. We also had the Israeli siege that was all over Gaza, and Israel was controlling the airspace, they were controlling the seawater, they were controlling lots of things in Gaza, which made the life more terrible to the people there. Actually, it wasn't only Israel, we also had Egypt, who were also sieging Gaza. Anyway, I continued with that and had just my normal life, until in the university, I had to choose to what university I should go, and because we don't have much options also, it's a small city, so I went to the Islamic University of Gaza, which is also a Hamas owned and run. It's where their leader studies, Sinwar, Deif, Hani, everyone studies there, and it was a very intense experience actually in this university, because on the one hand, you have to choose what you want to study. For me, I wanted to study engineering, Middle Eastern. My father was engineer, so for sure I will be an engineer. And the first year and a half in this university, I noticed that, yes, we are studying engineering, but it was more about using engineering for military stuff than it's about using it for civilian infrastructure or purposes. I still remember, actually, one of my teachers was Dr. Jamal Zibda, who was more interested in developing Hamas's tunnels, rockets capabilities, more than he was interested in teaching us engineering. I didn't know that until in some of the wars that happened in Gaza, and we have lots of them, he was killed, and they started to announce that this was the guy who developed Hamas's rockets. And I was shocked that I was in the same class where he was teaching. Anyway, after a year and a half, I decided to change from engineering, and I went to the accounting department. And until 2019, I was not active in any way in politics, Palestine and Israel, or even Gaza. But because of the authoritarian nature of Hamas's rule over Gaza, the first requirement when you want to apply for a job in the public sector was to be part of the member, like any authoritarian regime, Soviets, Ba'athists, whatever. And I did not qualify for that, so I was always faced with this thing that whenever I apply to a job, I pass the interview, the job exam, and then I'm rejected. So I started to have some anger on Hamas, and I wanted to express that anger. At the same time, in the university itself, it's a hub where they recruit people. They start to notice who qualifies to be a Hamas member or not. And they started to offer that to us, including me. And when they offer that, they understand that there is also people who do not believe in this ideology of jihad or Islamism or whatever. So what they do is that they offer economical benefits. I'm talking about a car, job. Actually, the minimum salary for a Hamas fighter is more than a doctor's salary in Gaza. So you can imagine the benefits that they offer you. At the same time, you have this terrible economical situation that is caused by both the Israeli siege over Gaza and Hamas's rule, which made the Gaza society as a two layers. One is the wealthy elite of Hamas's members, supporters, leaders, and the remaining society who just struggles to live in this situation. And I saw with my own eyes in the university some people who did not have anything to do in common with Hamas or any opinion about this conflict, but they joined because they were suffering from this economical situation and they wanted better lives. And they also noticed that, unfortunately, since Hamas took over the power in 2007, everyone was dealing with Hamas as if it was a status quo, that it's okay, Hamas is ruling Gaza, no one cares about that, and you will have to live with that. And I'm not talking only about Palestine itself, I'm talking about Arab countries, Western countries, Israel itself, who were also allowing the Qatari money to enter to Hamas on a monthly basis. So everyone was desperate that, okay, we don't see an exit for that. And I saw some of my friends joined Hamas because they wanted these benefits. Thankfully, I did not. And that was until 2019. But before I go to 2019, I just want to show you a small video of my neighborhood, Al Rimal neighborhood, how it was in Gaza for two reasons. One is that I love this neighborhood, but unfortunately what is left from it right now is just ruins. Most of the people who were living there are either killed, wounded, displaced, or whatever. And the other thing is how people also looked to Gaza before, because the majority were looking at Gaza as a dark room. Yes, to an extent it was, but if you compared it to some Middle Eastern cities, in a way or another, it was better. And I think this video does not show a lot, but it will show you just a sign of how we were living in my neighborhood. It's a small video, but I will also try to show another one.
على هذه الأرض سيدة الأرض أم البدايات أم النهايات كانت تسمى فلسطين صارت تسمى فلسطين سيدتي أستحق لأنك سيدتي أستحق الحياة
saying we deserve to live. Yes, we do actually. Yeah, and this how was the neighborhood. And if you looked at it right now, according to the most statistics, if you look to the UN, 70 to 80% of this neighborhood, like 8 of 10 houses are destroyed from this neighborhood, and it became ruins. Anyway, after I was supposed to graduate from this university, I started to hear about a new movement called We Want to Live movement. And this movement was formed from the society itself, from the civil society, and it had only two goals to achieve. One is to have better economical situation because we couldn't continue living with this. The second one is to have elections in Gaza because, for those who don't know, we only had one time elections in our lives in Gaza in 2006, and the majority of us did not attend it. I mean, Gaza society, more than 50% is under the age of 18, so most of the society did not even see these elections but had to live with the consequences of it. So we wanted these elections in a way or another to have another government, something other than Hamas. So we protested in the streets. And it was only one slogan, we want to live. And the moment we entered the streets, immediately Hamas, that was in 2019, and in March 2019, and Hamas sent their militias to us to beat as much as they could, to arrest as much as they could. And unfortunately, I was one of those who were arrested back then, and I had to have this terrible experience in Hamas's jails because they don't just have any red lines. Everything is allowed there, and it's not something that you would wish for anyone, even for Hamas's peoples themselves. And I was arrested back then, and after a few weeks, my family managed to find a Hamas's official to bribe to get me out of the jail. That succeeded, and after this experience, I preferred to keep my head down because there was no, much media coverage of what happened for the people to see that there is people in Gaza saying we oppose this regime, or human rights organizations to talk that there is thousands of people, more than 2,000 people from Gaza were arrested from the protest. So you can imagine how big it was. We were being tortured in these jails and no one talked about us. So to an extent, we lost hope that people are not interested actually in the civilians in Gaza who are trying to change the situation. Kept my head down until 2023 in June, a few months before the war, and we decided to protest again. And it was a crazy idea for me actually to do that because Hamas has a system for those who try to oppose them, and they record if you protested before and you were jailed before, you are in the system. And now I'm in a way or another, I'm trying to lead the protest. So we protested again, and it was more numbers actually than 2019. The same slogans, without any political attention, without any political attachment or attachment to foreign countries. We protested again, and the same thing happened. I was arrested again, and I had to go this not a nice experience in Hamas's jails. And for them, the moment I entered the police station, they took our IDs, and they realized that I was here before. I protested against them in 2019, so I had to have special kind of experience, if one can say, which was worse than the first one. And the same thing that happened in 2019 was repeated in 2023. We got out of the jail, my family paid the bribe, no media is talking about us, no human rights is talking about us. So I said, it's not my conflict, I can't change it. So I'm just gonna leave this trip, I don't care actually. What happens to Palestine and Israel is not my issue. I don't have any power to change anything. And before I move forward, I just want to show you a small video of this protest.
Osama Khaloud can barely sit because he's in so much pain. A young journalist who went to cover the protests happening outside of his house. The hunger protests, as they have been dubbed, have been held all over the Gaza Strip. Osama documented the ones in his neighborhood on his social media accounts and with his camera. Soon after, he says members of Hamas broke into his house, beat him up, and destroyed his equipment. He then says he was taken away and tortured for 3 days.
I knew the sensitivity of covering such an event, and so I didn't want to cover it. I was criticized for that by my neighbors because I'm the only journalist here. So then I went to cover the event, and suddenly Hamas police stormed my house, beating me up, destroyed my kit, and took me away.
Hamas says it's cracked down on the protests because certain groups want to bring disorder to the streets of Gaza.
I don't deny that there are some mistakes, and these mistakes will be investigated by the police. And we are against any violation of the law. We are against using of power against or violence against people. But, you know, some people try to...
This is actually Hamas's spokesman, Ghazi Hamad, who said they're going to investigate. 22 people were killed under torture in their jails, and until now there is no results of what happened or who should be held accountable for these barbaric crimes, to be honest. And even the accusations in their jails were extremely stupid. One of my friends, Isam Safin, he was also protesting with us, and the crime he had is to work with the Palestinian Authority. This is a crime under Hamas's law, to work with the Palestinian. I'm not talking about Israel, I'm not talking about foreign countries or America, I'm talking about the Palestinian Authority. He was tortured to death for that, because he's somehow working with the Palestinian Authority. And he wasn't the only one. Lots of people were killed, lots of people were tortured to a bad extent. And after that, I decided just to leave the Gaza Strip and just to have a new life in the West. And I made my own way from Gaza to Cairo, from Cairo to Turkey, from Turkey with these immigration boats or the death boats, actually, to Greece. 1 month after I left Gaza, actually, 23rd of August 2023, just 5 weeks or something like that before the war. And yeah, I made my way to Greece, and 1 month after October the 7th happened, and I started to see the videos, and it was shocking for me. At the beginning, I said it may be Israeli propaganda, it may be Hamas propaganda, because we didn't see such a scale of violence before, even from Hamas against Israel. We didn't see something like that before. And I started to see the videos that was coming from there, and until we confirmed that it actually happened. Everyone, actually, if I know in this report I was talking to, he told me they opened the gates of hell. We are just registering to leave Gaza Strip to Egypt because we understand how this will end up. They did, and they kidnapped the Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, in 2006, and we saw the consequences for one soldier. So you can imagine they killed more than 1,200, not to mention the more than 250 hostages. And everyone started to register to leave Gaza, including my family, including my close friends. And yeah, we were seeing that. And I saw one video, actually, coming from Gaza, I decided to speak. It was this video when there was a small group from Gaza, 100 to 200 people, celebrating what Hamas did. And I understood back then how this video will be used. Some people will use it to portray that, oh, you have 2 million terrorists in Gaza, you have 2 million people supporting Hamas. They won't understand that the majority of the moderates who oppose what Hamas did, they can't say it publicly. If they did, they will be held accountable for that. And some of them actually did. So I realized that I should speak, that I don't want this moment when I was there in the jail, I was feeling betrayed that no one is speaking about the moderates in Gaza. I didn't want that to be repeated to anyone. That was my only idea. I did not decide to have something big. I just wanted to be one voice of the moderates in Gaza. And I started to speak, and I did not wait to condemn what they did, because yes, on the one hand, we have too many problems with Israel. We have the occupation, the siege, the crimes that happens in the West Bank, but that does not in any way justify what Hamas did. So I decided to speak, and unfortunately, I was in this refugee camp in Greece when I started to speak, and I did this video, slept, woke up the second morning to see that most of the Israeli embassies shared this video, and people who are newcomers from Gaza who are in the refugee camp understood that in a way or another, I'm working with the Israeli embassies. I did not work with them, and I don't have any control on who shares my videos. So I started to have these problems in the camp, and I was threatened, actually, in the camp that if I spoke about Hamas's spokesman, Abu Ubaida, again, the guy is going to cut my neck. And I went to the camp administration to report about that. Their decision was move one to another camp, and that's it. So if he wanted to do something, it's just 1 hour from my camp. And I moved to this camp until I got my papers there, continued to speak when I was in Thessaloniki. And I remember back then, I wrote just an article for Newsweek. It was titled Message to the Gazans, Demand the Release of the Hostages, if not out of moral obligation, actually, just to save whatever is left from Gaza, because that was in the middle of the war. Back then, part of my family was in Gaza, and they went for my mom in her tent after we lost our home and we moved from Gaza City to Khan Yunis in the south. They went to my mom and they said in Arabic that Dammu Muhallal, which means the moment he enters Gaza, he's dead. It's something like a red list for Hamas, for people who are known to oppose Hamas. My family had to say publicly that we don't have anything to do with him. We don't agree. Talk to him. It's not our problem. And since then, I realized that if I want to speak, I have to get my family out of there. If not, I have to stop, because it wasn't an option, actually. At the end of the day, for me, my family is before Palestine, before Israel, before everything. And I thankfully succeeded to get my family out of Gaza and continued with my activism. But unfortunately for some newcomers, not all of them, that wasn't acceptable. And they started to harass, threaten me, and to see me something like a traitor of Gaza because I opposed Hamas. That doesn't mean that I was supporting Israeli military actions. All my stance was just criticize what Hamas did, because I'm not supporting the Israeli military actions. Anyway, I had to leave Greece because of these threats, because I also noticed how the authorities unfortunately respond to these things. And I moved to Germany, and in Germany, I exploded with my activism, I would say. I started to go to universities, to events, to the parliament, to every way I can, for just a few things, to say that first and foremost, this war should stop yesterday, if not now, actually. And to say that there is people in Gaza who oppose Hamas, and I believe that was clear even during the war, when the people in Gaza decided to protest against Hamas, even during the war, during the bombardment, the starvation, the displacement, everything. They decided to tell the world that Hamas is a terrorist organization, we don't want them, and we want this war to stop. That's it. Unfortunately, Hamas also met these people as they did actually in 2019. One of my friends, Uday Nasser al-Rabai, 22 years old guy who has not much opinions about the conflict. He was just, we don't want Hamas, we don't want the war. He was tortured to death. And when I saw the video of his body, it was terrifying. And you can imagine, the reason I'm saying these things is for you to imagine the cost of speaking against Hamas in Gaza, because unfortunately many people don't like or say that the people in Gaza should overthrow Hamas. We tried, and we continue to try, but you also should understand that it's not easy to protest against such a terrorist regime when there is a gun pointed to your head, and there is no one to defend you, actually. That was what happened to Uday. The same happened to Ahmed al-Masri, who's also one of our friends. And yeah, that's how Hamas met these people. At the same day, when I look at these people and I also look at the West, I see a totally different scenario. In Gaza, I see them chanting, Hamas is a terrorist organization, we want this war to stop. I look at the West, I wouldn't generalize and say all of the protests, but many of them actually, especially in the US, some in Berlin, I would say, glorifying Hamas. The people in Gaza who are living under Hamas saying it's a terrorist organization, but here, no, they are supporting them. The people in Gaza say, we want this war to stop, but here they say, no, we want Intifada. Those people don't have any idea what Intifada was. Intifada, in the second Intifada, it was just a matter of suicide bombs. Everyone was scared before entering a cafe or a school bus because of the bombs. And if you are on the Palestinian side, more Palestinians than Israelis were killed in the second Intifada. If you are on the Israeli side, mostly civilians were killed from the Israeli side. So I have no idea who are those people who are chanting for Intifada. Whether you are pro-Israel or pro-Palestine, it's not an option. It's not an option. And we already have a devastating war in Gaza. So no, we are good. What we want is first for this war to stop, and for something to be rebuilding Gaza. And when I talk about rebuilding Gaza, I'm not talking only about rebuilding concrete buildings and stuff like that. We also have to rebuild the society there. Because It's hard for me actually to say it, but we have to rebuild the society. The people there lived with Hamas, a terrorist regime, since 2006. It's like 18 or 19 years, so we are talking about a period more I think than Germans lived with Nazi Germany. So you can imagine the indoctrination those people had from Hamas. They should have programs to de-radicalize this society and what they absorbed from Hamas. And I think in the Middle East, we have lots of examples to learn from, whether we are talking about Emirates, whether we are talking about Saudi Arabia, who were 10 years ago, not a single Jew would think of going to Emirates, but now they have synagogues. The same applies to Saudi Arabia, who were 10 years ago with the Sahwa and Wahhabism and this radical Islam, but now you have Taylor Swift in Saudi Arabia. So yes, we can learn from this experience, and I'm not saying that as a self-hating Palestinian, but I'm saying that because I want to see my society as the best as it can be. And when I talk about that, the same applies to the Israeli side, because I believe, yes, in Gaza we might have more radicalism than it's on the Israeli side, but if you looked at the Israeli society post-October the 7th at least, you have this crazy spike in radicalism. You have some communities who literally protested just to prohibit the humanitarian aid from entering the Gaza, or the crazy terrorist Israeli settlers actually in the West Bank who are attacking civilian Palestinians almost on a daily basis, according to OCHA, which is an organization attached to the UN. In 2024, you have at least on average 4 attacks by Israeli settlers against the Palestinian communities. In 2025, it's 5 actually in a day. So you can imagine how the spike is crazy in the Israeli society, and it's actually affecting the Israeli society itself, because there are crazy groups in Israel right now who are opposing a ceasefire deal or that will bring the hostages back to their families. The families of the hostages themselves started to complain from what's happening there. So yeah, this is a small part from my experience.
Yeah, thanks for all the insights. I would propose that I start with a few questions I have, and then we can open the discussion. So you are all free to come in the front, and we have an extra microphone, so you can ask your questions. But I'll start with the beginning of your talk. You spoke about having difficulties finding a job, and that's why you were part of the movement We Want a Better Life. We want to live. But can you tell me how Hamas was established their rule on an everyday basis? Like, what did the everyday life look for people like you, and especially also for women?
Actually, since they took over the power, they did not leave any safe place in Gaza. Schools, universities, mosques, everything. They spread like a cancer almost everywhere. I can't think actually of an institution or organization that in a way or another you don't have Hamas people there. And that's not to defame the organization itself or the institution, but to tell you how they spread. And as I said, after they took over the power in 2007, they started to replace every employee in Gaza, the public employees, the government's employees. They replaced the teachers, they replaced the imam mosques, they replaced the people who work for the government, and they started their indoctrination even outside of these buildings. Like if we are talking about a mosque, unfortunately, if you ask any typical Gazan, even the conservative Muslims, they stopped going to the mosques because it became a recruitment places for their activism.
And do you think they used religion also?
The thing about the Gaza society is, if you compare the Gaza society to the Middle East, I can't think actually of a society who is more religious than us. Maybe only Saudi Arabia to an extent, but the Gaza society became actually, it wasn't like this. Became after Hamas took over the power, became extremely attached to religion, and they used religion to manipulate people, because it's an affront to use people, and it was easy for them. So they started to radicalize the people in a way or another with the religious discourse in the in these mosques that became actually very hard to avoid, because every mosque in Gaza became a Hamas mosque. And at the end of the day, those people is a Muslim community who wants to go to the mosque. And whether they noticed that or not, they were being indoctrinated in these mosques. And the unfortunate thing is that they actually started to take the mosque thing beyond the Palestine and Israel thing. There is, I think, a recorded interview for Mahmoud Zahar, who is a co-founder of Hamas. When he was asked about Palestine and Israel, he said that our project is beyond Palestine and Israel. We want to do this Islamic state, and that was in a mosque. And I remember, I don't actually remember what year exactly, but I was in the mosque. And normally in Friday prayers, you have a speech after the before the prayer, and normally an official comes, which is a Hamas official. And I remember back then there was Fathi Hamad, who was an interior minister for Hamas, and he came to this speech, to this prayer. And there was back then an escalation with Israel, and there was some rockets fired, and it was a closed circle. And when asked about these rockets, if it's directed towards a military base or an army thing, he answered that no. And by logic for him, by his logic, anyone who lives in Israel is a legitimate target. And we could have seen that being applied by Hamas when they attacked in October the 7th. It was not only for Jews, because some people say it was only an anti-Semitic attack. It wasn't like this. They attacked Muslims, they attacked Thailand people, Thai people, they almost attacked everyone. There were actually people from Gaza who were working in Israel in this day. By coincidence, they were there and they were killed. Because, and there is a video for that, when they were asked, they were like, you are working for the kuffar, so you can... Imagine this mentality that sees everyone as a legitimate enemy. Also in the university, I remember at the Islamic University, I had one course of Islamic Sharia law. And I remember our teacher, how upset he was, because we had this small Christian library close to the university. And he was in the mood that Hamas should close this library, and we shouldn't have a library that have a Bible in Gaza. So we have a minority of Christians actually in Gaza.
I compared a little bit to Turkey now. I have a Turkish heritage, and in Turkey under Erdogan's rule, they of course also put their teachers, their government officials in the schools, etc. And they had like the ideological idea of to Islamize the society a bit more. But after a few years, after they installed all the Islamic schools, or like a majority of Islamic schools, there was like a counter movement that people were moving away from religion. So, and people turning more to Judaism or becoming more secular just out of spite, or just because they saw the facade of it. So how do you analyze Islam and Islamism of Hamas? Because people who are Muslim, of course, they are interested in peace and living their lives, having a good life for themselves and their children. And most people I talk, of course, they are against the war, people who are not radicalized. So do we have some notion on that?
I think that Erdogan was trying to give the quote-unquote cute Islamism to the world. And yeah, they are also trying to do it now in Syria with this crazy guy. Anyway, in Gaza, I would say it's a bit different. It's a bit different because, no, Hamas was attached to two forces. One is the Islamic regime in Iran, and one is the Muslim Brotherhood. So we were importing this terrible ideology from two factions. And it was actually said during the revolution in Egypt in 2013, when the leader, Khayrat al-Shatir, who was the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood around the world, when he entered Gaza, he said that Hamas is the military arm of the Muslim Brotherhood. That was in a public speech. It's recorded, and you can find it online. At the same time, you have another faction of Hamas who's more attached to the Islamic regime in Iran. It's not only Hamas. You also have the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And those are terrible people. Like, the idea of jihad for them is centered. It's number one. You can never discuss this idea with those people. And as I said, it's not about Palestine and Israel for them. It's more about achieving this crazy idea of a big Islamic state.
A difficult topic. Of course, I see that there is a very hard influence of the regime in Iran and helping radicalize the people. But I have one more question. Do you see what role women in general played in Gaza?
It's a hard question that, I mean, when we look at Gaza, we shouldn't look at with the German with the German eye. We shouldn't look at the Gaza society with a Western eye, because as every Middle Eastern country, or most of them actually, women plays little to no role, unfortunately. And yeah, Gaza was one of those societies. Don't give me that look that we are a terrible society. The entire Middle East is at the same way. If you looked at Syria, if you looked at Jordan, if you looked at whatever country, they have play little to no role. But actually, we started to do some role. And if you looked at the protest during the war, there was a protest only for women in Gaza who opposed Hamas. And they protested also during the war, so I have much respect to them. Hopefully, in the future, they can play more role, but it wasn't easy for them to play this role in the Middle East on the one hand, and especially that we are ruled by Islamists who oppose giving the woman any role in the political or the social life.
Okay, so you say the oppression of Hamas was so strong that the society went kind of very quiet.
I mean, from 2006, and you can count 8 years, we had Fathi Hamad as an interior minister. And I remember back then when we were walking at the beach, even men were not allowed to wear a short for so you can imagine how it is for the woman. We had this morality police from them that if you are working with a woman that is not your wife or have a family relationship, you will be both arrested. So it's extremely hard for women to play such a role under such a totalitarian terrorist regime.
Yes. My last question before we open it up, and to get closer to the topic of this evening, what do you say? What can be a credible and also sustainable peace dialogue between Palestinians and Israelis, civil society? How can that look like? Do you see any concrete approaches hope?
I will get my magic trick. I told you about that. I would say that first and foremost, we all agree that Hamas must go for sure, because it's. I don't think we would have any hope for peace when they are ruling there. The same applies actually to the Israeli government, because I can't see Ben-Gvir or Smotrich handing the Palestinians a peace treaty right now. And for me, in my opinion, actually, I think that there is a criminals and war crimes that happened by this government. And for the better of the Israeli society and the Palestinian society, the leadership must go. I wouldn't say that peace would come at the second day, but I would say if there was a role to be supported by the Arab states, especially the Gulf states, who had this process of de-radicalization, normalization, and having good relationship with Israel, they can also support on that. But still, both of us, we have to make some compromises. We, the Palestinians, we can't go with this stupid idea of armed resistance that we have been trying since 48 until now, and every time we see the consequences of it, and we continue to repeat it. This is one thing. If we looked at the other side, there must also be compromises by the Israeli side, because I can't make peace while I'm seeing settlements expanded in the West Bank. We are now talking about more than 700,000 Israeli settlers illegally living in the West Bank. So they also must show the Palestinians, okay, if you dropped in one idea, we can't support you in another idea. But what we are seeing right now is quietly the opposite, unfortunately. So I would say that both leadership must go, and we should have something new in these two societies. And for us, especially the Palestinians, we have to give up on many taboos that we have been dealing with since 1948. And when I say taboos, one idea is this from the river to the sea idea, take all over the land. That would never happen, and it's immoral, and it shouldn't actually be discussed. This is one thing. The second thing, for example, the right of return. While it's legitimate, in my opinion, those people were displaced from their lands, but when I look right now, we are talking about 8 million. I can't see how I can put these people in what is right now the state of Israel. And unfortunately, we have been dealing with this taboo in every Palestinian, in every peace treaty, whether we are talking Oslo, Camp David, or whatever, and it all the time it makes problems. And I think we should realize that it's not applicable. That doesn't mean the right is not legitimate. It's legitimate, and those people should be compensated, whether financially, relocated to other countries, not to continue living in this terrible situation, as it happens with every society after a war. It happened with Turkey and Greece, actually. So we can't continue with these taboos.
Yeah, thank you.
In O-Ton-Playback bei Radio Dreieckland hörtet ihr Exil und Engagement, eine palästinensische Sicht auf Frieden und Demokratie. Der Mitschnitt einer Diskussionsveranstaltung im Nordpol in Dortmund am 17. Juli 2025 mit Hamza Hovidi. Wir sendeten den ersten Teil des Mitschnitts. Den zweiten Teil könnt ihr in der kommenden Ausgabe von O-Ton-Playback hören. Die gesamte Veranstaltung findet ihr auf freie-radios.net als Mitschnitt.